You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 28th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Attorney General Eric Holder expresses his deep sense of remorse regarding the seeking a warrant to get all the records of a reporter's emails and phone calls, and calling him a co-conspirator, attempting to at least aid and abet espionage. Also on the program today, President Obama's aggressive move. He's actually going to attempt to appoint judges. The IRS scandal, not only is it falling apart for Republicans, but it is revealing a deeper, more sinister scandal. And for those of you who enjoyed a happy Memorial Day, know that as far as rich nations go, you get far less paid vacation time than any of them. Except, of course, if your name is Michael and you work in this office.
I'm leading the way.
Leading the way. big strike today against Walmart. It is the first ever prolonged strike. Employees in Miami, Massachusetts, in the California Bay Area this morning have started a strike without a union. They're backed by a group, or I should say their association, Our Walmart, is backed by unions. They are not unionized. They are going to, at least 100 workers have pledged to join the strike, and they will be walking off the job for about 10 days until June 7th, at least, when Walmart is holding its annual shareholders meeting. This is, we've seen this now starting to happen around the country. Low-wage workers now in almost a half a dozen cities have been striking against fast food restaurants. We saw a one-day strike last week in Washington, D.C., low-wage workers working for the U.S. government, or I should say working for outfits that are subsidized by taxpayers. So this is spreading around the country, and we will continue to follow it as the news unfolds. I want to talk a little bit today about Obamacare, which is, as you know, beginning to roll out, and some interesting developments on that front. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, Matt is, well, I don't know. He's got the blues today, folks. And a big part of that is because, well, his computer has died. So there you go. This is Now, Matt, of course, can't play this because his computer has died, and that's usually where we get our sound. But do you want to say a couple of words, Matt? I mean, it was a 15-inch...
I miss you.
MacBook Pro. Fortunately, the hard drive is intact, but it appears to be the motherboard.
Something. Something.
And that machine's from 2010. I don't know what you do to that computer. My MacBook Pro is still functioning from 2008. So maybe it's not the machine. Maybe it's the user. But just wanted to acknowledge that. That is why, of course, we had 14 starts to the show today. In case you are wondering, the number 646-257-3920 is 3920. 646-257-3920. We will take your phone calls as the show progresses. We'll do it a little bit early. We've got a great lineup of guests this week for you. And I wanted to make sure that I got to some of these stories. Now that I'm so fresh coming off Memorial Day weekend, which, of course, I just get less sleep during the weekends. That's just the way it is. Let's start first with a poll from CNN on Obamacare. 54% of Americans oppose Obamacare, otherwise known as the Affordable Care Act. This is according to a CNN poll released on Monday. 43% percent support the law. Perhaps relevant in some respects because the Congress passed its, what, 38th, I don't know. You lose count at one point. The House voted to repeal Obamacare again last week because they can't seem to find anything else to do. But here is their problem. While 54% oppose the law, when you dig down into the poll, and not very far, 35% of the country, you remember that magic number, 35%. That was the Bush dead enders. For years, it was always hovering in the low 30s of people who still supported George Bush. 35% of the country opposes the law because it's too liberal. While 16% argues it isn't liberal enough. And in many respects, I would probably, if I was asked that question, I would probably fit in that 16%. But the law exists. And the question is, what happens next? Because those 16% are not people who would necessarily want Congress to repeal it. They would want Congress to fix it and make it better. Perhaps by making it a single payer, we don't know, system. Support among other age groups fall as low as 31% among senior citizens. I would be willing to wager that at least a small portion of that, and perhaps not so small, is because they were under the misapprehension that it in some way implicates their Medicare, which it does not. So what is clear from this is that there is still a significant majority that not only wants healthcare reform, but wants it to go further. And this really, in many respects, is before any of the law's best attributes come into play. We know up to this point that if you were under the age of 26, you could remain on your parents' healthcare plans. Millions of under 26ers have taken advantage of that. We know that it set up high risk pools, which were not participated in the numbers that had been speculated and hoped. Those high risk pools will become moot when Obamacare kicks in at the end of 2014, fall of 2014, because if you have pre-existing conditions, you will no longer be able to be denied health care coverage. And the wonks, the healthcare wonks, are now starting to champion this story coming out of California. And we've spoken on this program at many times, some more than others, as to what to anticipate come this fall. There are, the law calls for 50 state exchanges to be set up, whereby if you do not get employer health care coverage and you are not eligible for expanded Medicare, I put a little asterisk there because we know the Supreme Court has made that dynamic a little hinky, but let's just stay in this area of exchanges. If you do not get employer health care coverage, or if health care coverage provided by your employer constitutes more than 9.5% of your income, you are eligible for these exchanges. The idea behind these exchanges was that it would bring in healthcare insurers, put them in one central location, literally a website, where you could shop for different types of plans at different price points. The idea is that within the state, it would create competition. The insurance that was provided in these exchanges or offered in these exchanges would have had to hit a minimum federal standard and any greater state standard in terms of what this healthcare must provide and comport with the state's regulations. Some 26 states, I think it was, basically said, we're not doing it. We're going to allow the federal government to set up our health exchange for us. This has made implementation a little bit more difficult, but supposedly these health care exchanges will be ready by October. Some states have been aggressive in trying to make these work. Other states have been aggressive in trying to make these exchanges not work. California is one of those states that immediately upon the passage of this law set up their exchange. Now understand, if you enter into this exchange, from the very beginning you are offered certain plans that are available there. If your income falls between 400% and, I guess, 100% of poverty, or 133% of the poverty line, you are eligible for federal subsidies, depending on where your income lies, how big your family is, et cetera, et cetera. So California set up this exchange. It will have 13 insurance options. In 2009, the CBO predicted that a medium level, a so-called silver plan, as opposed to a gold plan or a bronze plan, and for those of you who follow the Olympics, you know in which order those run, gold, silver, and bronze. A silver plan, which covers 70% of a beneficiary's expected health costs, the CBO predicted that on the California Health Exchange, it would cost $5,200 annually. More recently, apparently, a report from a consulting firm predicted it would carry a $450 monthly premium. Not good with math, but that's more around the same as that annual estimation, more or less. Well, now California has announced the actual prices. It will have 13 insurance options, and apparently the exchange is working. The most affordable silver level plan, and I guess you have multiple plans within those three categories, is $276 a month. The second most affordable plan is $294 a month. This is all before subsidies. So how much you will actually pay will be a function of your income. Someone making twice the poverty line, 200% of poverty, will pay $104 a month. Spare plans are even cheaper, according to Sarah Cliff at Washington Post. A young person buying the cheapest bronze level plan will pay $172 a month. And again, that is before any subsidies. So there is at least some reason to believe that insurance prices are going to be even less in many states than had been anticipated upon the ratification of the Affordable Care Act. In Oregon, apparently what happened, one insurer came in with a monthly premium cost in the $169 range. Other insurers wanted to charge more than $400. In seeing what their competitors were charging, two insurers came back to the state's regulators and asked if they could refile at lower rates. So it seems to be working in states that have been aggressive and embraced the Affordable Care Act. Now, there are some caveats to this, aside from the fact that there are several states, and we'll get into that, who have done everything they can to foul this up. Texas comes to mind. The other, there are other hinks. Hinks? Kinks in the system. And part of that is, and I want to reiterate here that I would have loved to have seen a public option. We have some measure of a public option in the form of the Affordable Care Act, at least in about 25 states, providing the seed money for co-ops, which are nonprofit insurance companies. The federal government has provided seed loans because, of course, it's very hard to start this up. You need to have a certain amount of capital to begin with, which will perform the same function. These the extension of these co-op financing was, I think, basically ripped out in the fiscal cliff deal. So, like I say, only exists in about 26 states. The best we can hope from the Affordable Care Act is that it's going to provide models in some states that are going to create pressures nationally. That is going to take a while. One thing that we were told throughout this process was that the Affordable Care Act is a work in progress, not unlike Medicare was, not unlike Social Security was, not unlike SCHIP was. The law is passed. It becomes clear what is problematic with it. It becomes refined and honed and fixed in some respects. We know that in Vermont, we're going to see, in all likelihood, a single-payer program that hopefully will be a model and create pressure on other states to adopt such a plan. The problem with the theory of it getting fixed as problems come up, as different interested parties say, hey, we have a problem with this, we have a problem with that. Now, the data as to whether or not, and because the Affordable Care Act says that if you have full-time employees who are getting 30 hours or more, they constitute a full-time employee. You got to give them health insurance. If you have people, if you have a company that has more than 50 employees, you got to give them health insurance. There have been different data sets and studies that have shown whether or not there are companies that are, or a significant number of companies that are starting to roll back some of their employees, just giving them 29 hours a month to avoid that. There is some anecdotal evidence that some companies are hiring only 49 people. I've seen studies that have contradicted that. We don't know, really, until probably a year into this thing, what's actually going to happen. However, there were hopes in the drafting of this bill, apparently, that some of those things, particularly those two points, would be fixed. But of course, we're now seeing the Republicans are refusing to tweak the bill on a national level because they still are beholden to these 75, 85% of Republicans who want it repealed. The rest of the country does not want it repealed. To the extent that there, as I mentioned in that poll, people are against Obamacare, only 35% want it repealed. 16% of those of the 51% who are against Obamacare want it to go further. So we have problems with the law. One of those glaring problems is that 9.5% of your household income that would make you eligible for the exchange. What is clear now is that there needs to be a statutory fix that computes that household income. It is the share of the income for an individual, but it does not take into consideration that you may also have a family of four. In which case, it becomes much more problematic. Because it basically only calculates the individual's cost of health insurance as opposed to what it would cost to get a family. Michael, you're looking at me like I'm not explaining this well. Oh, you do get it. All right, well, you need to work on your
I'm looking at it like
on your visual
cues. That's a significant
cues.
Problem. That's a significant problem. I'm giving you that.
It is a glitch that needs to be fixed. It will not be fixed. And there's some question as to whether or not Health and Human Services could change that, or the IRS, whoever's in charge of that regulation. As reported in the Times, the way that this law was drafted, the idea that a provision that takes back some of the subsidies if your income rises in the course of a year would have been softened. Democrats were debating the 50-employee definition for large businesses and were open to additional flexibility for seasonal workers and teenage employees. Some companies hire 55 employees during Christmas time, let's say, and then cut back to 35 for the rest of the year. These were all notions that would be fixed after the law passed, because they didn't have the ability to massage these things following the special election of Scott Brown to the Senate in January 2010. So the implementation of this is going to be rough. It's going to be even rougher in those states that have opted out of the Medicaid expansion, which was, in many respects, the centerpiece of this legislation. It was going to provide some 30 million people with health insurance. We now have a situation where if you make over 130% of poverty, between 130% and 400%, you are eligible for federal subsidies in these exchanges. If you make less than that, and you live in a state that has not increased Medicaid to 133% of poverty, you are SOL. You will get no health care coverage. We're talking about Texas and Florida, Kansas, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, all refusing to expand Medicaid to 133% of poverty. Even though for the first 5 years, 3 years, it would cost them nothing. After that, it would cost them 10% of those costs. People in those states who have incomes from poverty level up to four times that amount, $11,490 to $45,960 bucks a year for an individual, can get federal tax credits to subsidize the purchase of their health insurance. Like I say, the rest, SOL. CBO estimates 25 million people will gain insurance under the new health care law. Researchers at the Urban Institute estimate that nearly 6 million uninsured adults with incomes below the poverty level could also gain coverage, except that they live in states that are not expanding Medicaid. Here's just some quotes from advocates who work in those states. Bea Moorhead, executive director of Texas Impact. A lot of people will come in, file applications, and find they're not eligible for help because they are too poor. We have to tell them, if only you had a little more money, you could get insurance subsidies, but because you're so poor, you can't get anything. That's an odd message, a very strange message, and if people are sick, they'll be really upset. In Atlanta, the director of outreach and advocacy at Georgians for a Healthy Future, quote, hundreds of thousands of people with incomes below poverty level would be eligible for Medicaid if the state decided to move forward with the expansion. As things now stand, they'll not be eligible for anything. What do we tell them? The executive director of the Louisiana Primary Care Association. If the breadwinner in a family of four works full-time at a job that pays $14 an hour and the family has no other income, he or she will be eligible for insurance subsidies. But if they make $10 an hour, they will not be eligible for anything. This is the dynamic that has been created in those red states by Republican governors and Republican legislatures that have refused to expand Medicaid. And then the question becomes, will there be enough activism and organization in these states to make these people realize that this is a function of their state and not Obamacare? Now, I'm in no way endorsing this model, other, I guess, than beyond the status quo. And I think there is a tactical argument to be made that without any reform, there would be more pressure to move towards something more like a single payer. I think that there's probably a stronger argument that the examples that may be set in neighboring states might provide more leverage in terms of providing better healthcare reform down the road. I mean, we're obviously years away from this, but I'm quite convinced that, you know, things like the Berlin Wall fell because, you know, too many people were getting access to Western things like toilet paper and David Bowie concerts. I just remember as in college, my buddies and I went and we did a, we stopped in the, in East Berlin back in the day. And just taking a crap at, I think it was a museum there. And I had never experienced something so discomforting than Eastern European toilet paper. My sense was like a just, if you sent a B-51 bomber and just dropped rolls of American toilet paper, the wall would fall within days. I don't know that that's what happened, but I'm not convinced it wasn't. So it remains to be seen, but understand that's going to be the dynamic come this fall if you are lucky enough to live in a state like California that has been aggressive with these exchanges. You may find that you have an opportunity to get some form of decent health care coverage. And remember, the best parts of health insurance reform has to do with the regulations that say no rescission, no lifetime caps, no pre-existing conditions. I mean, the thing that is the hardest aspect of healthcare reform is that 80% of the costs of healthcare are borne by 20% of the population. You just never know if you're going to be one in five or four that is going to need your healthcare insurance to work the way that it's supposed to. You just never get to that point where you realize how decimating it can be when you are afflicted with a disease or you're hit by a bus, and after a couple of weeks in the hospital, your health insurance company says, you've busted through your lifetime cap. You're on your own. We will not see this happening anymore. We have begun to see a flattening of the growth rate in health insurance costs, or I should say health care costs. We're not 100% sure why this has happened. Some people speculate that it's a function of the recession, but we're also seeing this in Medicare, which theoretically should be immune from the broader economy. I happen to think it's a lot of drugs have come off patent. And so we're seeing a drug cost drop. But we don't know. So this is a good sign. And, you know, it's something to keep an eye on as we get closer, because this is going to become really big in our politics, I think, in 2014, if you can believe it. As disturbing as this will be, to have to relitigate this stuff. The other important story that is not going to get very much attention today, that I think deserves attention and will be a, could portend, we could see the beginning of some type of filibuster reform in the coming months as a function of this. It's certainly part of the strategy. The United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit is perhaps the second most powerful, maybe not even perhaps, is the second most powerful court in the country, short of the Supreme Court. It is where such things have happened that President Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board were found unconstitutional because the Senate wasn't really in recess. It is where we have seen a bevy of rulings that have curtailed the power of the EPA to do things like regulate air pollution across state lines. It has been a place where we've seen all sorts of corporate rulings. And on this court, there have been three vacancies. Now, the way this court works, it's now, as of last week, Srinivasan. Can you pronounce that for me, Michael? No?
Sorry, I don't have that one for you.
Was just successfully confirmed to this court. It's now made up of four Democratic appointees and four Republican appointees. It should be an 11-person court. There are six sort of emeriti judges who sit on that court and occasionally fill in. Five of them were appointed by Republicans. So today, the news that President Obama will announce three nominees simultaneously to this court. Three people who, from what I have read, are good nominees from a liberal perspective. Supposedly, they will be Cornelia T.L. Pillard, David Frederick, and Patricia Ann Millett. Pillard was an ACLU lawyer an NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund attorney. Frederick served as the law clerk to Byron White, worked in the Justice Department in the Solicitor General's office. Millett was also in the Solicitor General's office for a decade. She now is in private practice, in the appellate practice of a Washington law firm. All of these nominees are going to hit the Senate Judiciary Committee simultaneously. This is essentially an attempt either to fill these vacancies or to force a showdown over the filibuster. I think it was last week, Harry Reid, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, Harry Reid claimed that he was willing to revisit filibuster reform as chuckles ensue, and would do so perhaps through the nuclear option, which involves a parliamentary tactic trick in many respects, that would basically call for the parliamentarian to turn his back and vote to change the rules while the Senate is in session on a 51-person vote. It is dubious, but in many respects it's unprecedented. This is something that you generally do on the first session day of the Senate. Now, I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I may be mistaken about this, but I know Harry Reid had planned to keep the first day open for an extended period of time through a deal that he had made with the Republicans. I don't know if that's still in effect, but again, it's a parliamentary trick. Jeff Merkley was saying the other day that he thinks something's going to happen. So this appointment is... these nominees is being seen in that context. Supposedly, Reid has said privately that if the Republicans filibuster the Labor Secretary nominee, the EPA head, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau head, he is willing to go nuclear. And the idea is that obstruction on these three justices will provide the political air cover for that. So keep your eyes on this. These positions are crucial. President Obama has many, many vacancies, particularly on a district court level. What's that?
I think it's on an appellate level.
On an appellate level, there is still basically a mixed record. Also note that the Senate Republicans were threatening to change the makeup of this circuit court from 11 people to 8 people, which is sort of like a reverse court packing scheme. So instead of expanding it to 16 and appointing 7 or 8 new liberal judges, they would simply shrink the size of it so that the Republican dominance on this court could remain. That's not going anywhere. But it's interesting to see how this is playing out. We're going to take a break. I will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You can hear me calling in to the phone system as we speak. I will take your IMs. In the better half of the program, we're going to talk about Eric Holder's regrets, apparently, according to Daniel Kladman, who always seems to be the guy who sort of carries these stories. The inside story of regret and remorse. Perhaps I shouldn't have been so aggressive in calling a journalist a co-conspirator and an aider and abettor for a espionage suspect. It's a little sad. We will talk about that.
A little overzealous, like Claire Danes in Homeland.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, just a little emotional.
He got a little too emotional. We will talk about that. We will also talk about Bernie Kerik. Remember him? He's celebrating today. Also, Ron Paul. Yes, Ron Paul strikes out at the UN. Jeremy Hammond in a plea deal today. This is the kid who was basically locked up for a year, more or less, for passing on Stratfor emails to WikiLeaks. Just basically locked up for a year. He finally got to see a judge today and made a plea deal. And we'll also talk about what could be behind that flood of applications from right-wingers for special tax-exempt status and to keep their donors anonymous under the 501c4 rules. That ended up being a scandalous scandal with the Obama administration. Folks, it is your membership that makes this show possible. If I could get a nice computer that Matt could be working on now, he wouldn't be so, well, you'd be morose because your personal computer was. But just imagine what's going through Matt's mind right now. All those hours of Majority Report use. And he's thinking to himself, would my motherboard still be alive today if I didn't have to keep pressing buttons to make sounds on this show? Also, in the better half today, I may get to it today. I'm going to my 25th year college reunion this weekend, and I may have to go early because my nemesis at college is apparently doing the keynote address. Yeah, we'll talk about that in the better half. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 if you want to be part of the program. Otherwise, you can IM me at Majority FM. Tomorrow on the program, who do we have, Michael?
We have the editor of the Jacobin.
There you go.
Which is, that is like the 21st century socialist magazine of America. That will be a very interesting.
Arguably. All right. Yeah, this could be Socialism Week here at the Majority Report.
I think it is.
Yeah. All right, folks. See you in the better half.